Well, as we've already announced, we now have to give place to Brother Peter as he presents some of the recent developments in biblical archaeology. He hasn't asked for an introductory reading, so we will hand proceedings over to him. Thank you.
Well, dear brothers and sisters, I thought it would be best if we first defined the scope of our talk this evening. Recent developments in biblical archaeology. By recent, we're taking it to mean discoveries in the last 10 years or so. Now, whilst over the last 150 or so years, there have been very many dramatic discoveries made that confirm the Bible accuracy. We think of Hezekiah's tunnel in Jerusalem, the Taylor prism that recorded the invasion and attack upon Jerusalem, those great winged bull statues that guarded the palace of the kings of Nineveh. Recent years have seen much more localized and painstaking excavations that, whilst not so dramatic as the ones of a century ago, still confirm the accuracy of the Bible record, and that's the purpose of our present study, to look at some of these. All our examples this evening will be from sites in the land of Israel, and that is increasingly important because the Arabs are now claiming long historical links with the country that they and Israel now inhabit it. And those links, they say, are more deeply seated than the Jewish ones, even some of them denying that the Jews had any historical claim upon the land at all. And especially that's true of Jerusalem. So confirmation of the historical accuracy of the Bible record and the presence of Israel in the land centuries before Christ is very valuable. Now, recently, a landmark was reached in biblical archaeology. As this slide shows, this is a headline in the Biblical Archaeology Review of a year or so ago. It announced that archaeologists have discovered the existence and the identity of no less than 50 people who are mentioned in the Bible. And these have been, their existence has been independently confirmed by archaeological finds. Another recent development in the land of Israel relates to the Temple Mount that we see here, and that has accelerated the acquisition of these ancient artifacts that we're going to look at. It's rather a roundabout way of finding out about these things, because the Arabs refuse Israeli permission to excavate on this site. They say it's their site and they would do it themselves. Because their idea of excavation is to bring in a digger and a bulldozer. And they did that on the southeast corner of Jerusalem Temple Mount, as you see on that indicated on that slide. And their idea was to build down below and convert what is called Solomon's Stables, which in fact don't relate from the time of Solomon at all, but relate from the time of Herod the Great when he built the platform. These are the arches that supported it. They wanted to turn this into a mosque. And as a result, as I say, we brought in the bulldozers and the diggers, and they tipped all the spoil that's immediately above these arches on a site outside Jerusalem. Well, this spoil contained 3,000 years of Jerusalem's history. And horrified at the loss of this data, the Israeli archaeologists set up a camp just outside Jerusalem. Under a series of tents, they painfully brought up and sifted all this rubble that the Arabs had removed. And as a result, they found very, very many artifacts that otherwise would have been undiscovered. For example, this little cuneiform tablet, only about an inch or so long, but it describes a letter that the king of Jerusalem of about 1400 BC, about the time of Joshua, probably wrote to the king of Egypt. And it just shows how valuable that sifting method is. And as a result of the success of this, whenever there are any excavations in other parts of Israel, they bag up all the remains and they send them along here to this place at Jerusalem, and they sift through them, and some of the things that we will show you in a few moments were found by this method. So on to our more detailed studies of recent finds. We're going to go in chronological order, roughly, starting with the time of Abraham. As we said before, there aren't many what we call dramatic finds which have been unearthed, and we'll be seeing lots of ruins in the pictures on the screen this evening, but they still contain evidence of Bible truth, and that, after all, is what we're interested in. First of all, we go back to the time of Abraham and the time of Sodom. Now, where was Sodom? Well, over the centuries, many historians and archaeologists have put it in all sorts of different places. It's been at the bottom of the Dead Sea, so it can't be found anymore. It's on the cliffs to the southern end of the Dead Sea. But what the archaeologists and historians don't seem to have tried to do is actually look at what the scripture says. So if we ask where Sodom was, we're immediately directed towards Bethel. Because we're told that as Abraham went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, and when he was there, Lot, his nephew, lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go towards Zoar. That's in the delta area of Egypt. So this land where Sodom was situated was a very well watered one and very fertile. But we're told more specifically what happened, because when, as we know, Lot and Abraham separated, we're told, then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east and moved his tent as far as Sodom. So when you're looking at from the heights of the hill country of Judea at Bethel, and you go east, you go directly into this area, the north of the Dead Sea. And that is called the Plain of Jordan. Now, that word plain in the Hebrew is a very special word. It's not the ordinary word for plain. It, in fact, I think about 11 occasions it occurs in Scripture, 9 of them relate specifically to this area, the Plain of Jordan. And the word, Hebrew word, means kokar, and it means simply a circle. In Tel Aviv, there's a roundabout. You know what a roundabout is, don't you? Probably you don't have them in Australia, but certainly in this country we have plenty of them. You go round and round, and eventually you find your exit. Well, in the Tel Aviv and in other places in Israel, they call their roundabouts kikars, a circle. So that's basically what it means. So we can now locate Sodom somewhere in this circle, this plain of Jordan. It was obviously a very important town because, as we'll be reading in our readings today from Genesis and in our subsequent ones, that it was a major city. It excited the envy and the strategic advantage of the kings of Babylonia when they came down and when they captured Lot. So it wasn't a small city. And there is, just to the east of the Kirkar, a hill, an old buried city, a Tel El Hammam. And this was a major city in the time of Abraham, and they can date the ruins to that time. And there were other smaller cities alongside, remember, the Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim. Well, here is the Tel El Hammam. A very large site, as you can see, and it was excavated in 2005 by an archaeologist named Stephen Collins. I think he's the one with the light hat standing on the top of the wall there. They commenced excavating, and they found underneath this mound a huge city. Here are just some of the remains. But notably also, they found the gate of the city. This huge foundation here was the base of what they considered to be a huge three-story gateway. And there was another one the other side of the entrance. You might just see the tip of it off the screen. And they've been able to reconstruct that in this sort of format. So when we're told that Lot set his face towards Sodom and eventually sat in the gate of Sodom, this would have been something like his surroundings, a hugely fortified city. But of course we know that they were terrible people, completely immoral and lustful, and as a result we're told that the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah out of heavens. Brimstone, incidentally, doesn't refer to sulphur. The word simply means a burning stone. Well, when Collins started excavating, he found terrific evidence of this destruction. Here's one of the houses. Now, can you see at the base of that some very dark area? That is ash, wood ash from a burning city. And there wasn't just a little bit of it. That red mark indicates the level of the ashes up the wall when Collins got there. So there was obviously a huge conflagration that destroyed this city. The other thing you can notice is that some of those stones look very red. You can see that they have actually been burnt. And some of the clay bricks of which the walls are composed have actually been turned to stone, and one only does that with very intense heat, thousands of degrees. But even more telling is something else that he found. He found lots of skeletons. Now, normally, you might find the odd skeleton in an ancient city when you excavate it, but the majority of them would have been buried outside the city. But this time, there were skeletons littered around all of the city that they uncovered. So they'd obviously died suddenly. They hadn't been able to be buried. Even more interesting, a lot of them had broken legs, as if they had been cascaded upon from above. But even more interesting than that is something else that they found. To understand that, we need to go back to an atomic explosion. When the USA first detonated an experimental atomic bomb in a desert in Mexico called Trinity, after they went back to the site and it had cooled down, they found that the ground was littered with glass-like fragments. The soil and the clay had been turned into glass by the intense heat. Because it was where it was found, this is now known today as trinitite. Now, in Sodom, they found all the pottery that had been remained had been turned into this molten glass. On the left, we've got a potsherd from Sodom. On the right, we have a sample of trinitite from the atomic explosion. And this is only formed at temperatures of many thousand degrees centigrade. So obviously Sodom was destroyed by a huge fire of intense heat. And this wasn't only in Sodom. Over a wide area surrounding the city, this trinitite was found, these potsherds turned into glass. And after that, above that level of excavation, there was nothing. The city of Sodom then lay desolate for another 7 centuries and was only built in much later times. So I think the evidence is pretty clear that Tel El Hamam was the ancient Sodom. So now we can locate it quite definitely. And it fits in with all the biblical references of Abraham going out to meet him after Lot's recovered and so on. But the fact that this did happen, Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, then there are lessons in that for us, aren't there? Because Peter says that God turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an example unto those who should live ungodly. Even as Sodom and Gomorrah, says Job, and the cities about them in like manner are set forth an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Yes, and then we bear in mind the words of Jesus. Likewise also, as it was in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. And then those solemn words, even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So we already then have an important lesson from our study this evening. We're going on from the time of Abraham, we come to the time of Joshua. Here, the other side of the Jordan Valley, and up on the hill country of Ephraim, is Mount Ebal. And we read quite a bit about Mount Ebal in the Old Testament, because Deuteronomy tells us that Moses said to Joshua that there it shall be, when ye have crossed over the Jordan, that on Mount Ebal you shall set up these stones which I command you today, and you shall whitewash them with lime. You shall build with the whole stones the altar of the Lord your God, and offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord your God. Now Joshua built an altar to the Lord God of Israel in Mount Ebal. So he carried out the command that Moses had given him, and then was enacted that amazing ceremony of the tribes chanting the blessings and the cursings, and the ark was there to witness that particular occasion. But it was obviously an isolated altar. Well, here is Ebal and Gerizim. Ebal is the one on the left, and Gerizim is the one on the right, with the town of Shechem in between. And right on the top of Mount Ebal is a little mound which, although archaeologists have noted it, they haven't really excavated in any detail. Certainly it was looked at in the 1980s, I believe it was. But as there were no other buildings nearby, they thought it was comparatively unimportant. But then, only a few years ago, in 2005, they excavated it more closely, took away all the rubble there, and they found that underneath there's a definite structure, which they have found out was, in fact, an altar, and almost certainly the altar that Joshua built all those years ago. Here's a sideways view of it. You can see it's a central part of the altar itself, with two enclosures, one either side of a ramp going up to it. And if we look at an artist's impression of it, we have the actual formation of it was, maybe how it looked like in the days of Joshua. Now, how do we know that this heap of stones with this altar inside dates from the time of Joshua? Well, the reason is that in the excavation, they found two scarabs. Now, a scarab is a sort of a clay imprint of a pharaoh's name. And here they are, the cartouche of Thutmose III, who reigned in Egypt from 1479 to 1425, the very period which his Bible tells us was the time of the Exodus. And it was probably in use for a little bit longer because the other scarab dates from 1250 BC. An artist has given an impression of what it may have looked like when it was in operation. The two enclosures either side, they deduce, were maybe used for storing the animals. Certainly they were used for storing the ashes from the offering because it was full of ashes. And also a large number of bones, animal bones. All of them were clean animals. And they hadn't been broken, which it seems to imply that there had been the remains of the sacrificial offerings. So again, we've got an interesting confirmation of the Bible record. Coming on in history, we come to the time of David. Now, the thing we remember about David's early life was his exploits in the Valley of Elah when he defeated Goliath. Now, here is the Valley of Elah on the foothills of the Judean hills leading down to the coast. The city of Gath, where Goliath came from, would be just beneath and to the right of the left of the head of that arrow. Well, it was in Gath that they made an interesting discovery. Again, it was only very recently, just a few years ago. We learn of what happened there, that Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched in the Valley of Elah, set the battle in array against the Philistines, and there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Well, in Gath, a few years ago, was discovered this pottery fragment. They used to inscribe messages on pottery in those days. It didn't have paper. And scratched on this is the name Goliath. Now, I'm not suggesting that this was necessarily the Goliath of Scripture, but it does show that in Gath, Goliath was not an uncommon name for it to be inscribed on this pot. Well, we all know what happened to Goliath and how the Philistines fled back to their home territory, as this reference continues. And the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Shaaraim, even unto Gath and unto Ekron. Now that place, Shaaraim, again, has been excavated quite recently. It was a city in the lowlands, the Shephelah, as it's called. And here is Shaaraim, near, adjacent to the Valley of Elah. And what the archaeologists have discovered, that King David built a fortress, maybe even a palace, at Shaaraim in the Shephelah lowlands. And here's the excavations of Shaaraim. It's quite a large city with a wall all the way round. And in the top right-hand corner at the highest point, they've come across the remains of a huge fortress, probably almost a palace. And what they're suggesting is that this is David's summer palace, or maybe his winter palace if it was a bit cold up at Jerusalem, excuse me, in those days. Here are some of the excavations showing what an extensive place it was, all the rooms and the side rooms. Here's the gateway to it. And as you can see, it looks out over the Valley of Elah. Up to the left-hand side, you look up to the hills and you can see Jerusalem in the distance. If you look to the left, down towards the sea, you'd be able to see the Mediterranean itself. Obviously, a very strategic position for Israel to to defend itself against the Philistines, who were still a major enemy of Israel in those days, as we know from the biblical record. Here's the wall of the fortress, showing how big it was. Here are some of the rooms. Here we have a room which the archaeologist says were rooms that appear to be intended for residence. How they just know that, I don't know, but it does seem that they were residential accommodation. That's why they think it was a palace rather than a citadel. There's a building that appeared to be a royal storehouse and also a workplace that was uncovered. Evidence of metalworks, other industries, in addition to areas for storage of food and other items. So it's quite a well-supported little enterprise down at Shaarim. A third building was likely to be an administrative centre for the collection of the taxes that had to be levied on the crops. The farmers in the district would have brought in their revenue to the king, their crops, in these pots, and here they were stored in this particular area. In fact, one of them actually comes from Cyprus. But it all points, doesn't it, to a powerful and efficient administration, as we know that David actually had. Let's continue a bit with the time of David and go up the hill from Shaarim to Jerusalem. David was very active in Jerusalem, and the Bible tells us quite a few things that he did. Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David, and cedar trees, and carpenters, and masons, and they built David an house. And David perceived that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. And when that house was built, David was settled there and said to Nathan the prophet, "See, I dwell in a house of cedar." He was obviously a very palatial residence. Now, the city of David was not where the present old city of Jerusalem lies. You see, the old city, the southern part of which is the temple platform, is to the north, but south of that is a narrow ridge, only a few acres in extent, and is indicated by the dotted line. And that was the original city of Jebus that David conquered and made his capital. And it remained that throughout David's life and the early days of the reign of Solomon. Now, there's one interesting feature there. It is just about that point in the picture, on the slope going down to the Kidron Valley. And it's called the stepped structure, the stepped stone structure. And for years that has mystified archaeologists as to what it could be, why it was there. Many, many suggestions have been made over the years. Well, that is a feature which impinges on our study. But also above that, also for years, there's been known that on the level ground at the top along of the ridge was what they termed the large stone structure. And again, no one ever really understood what it was. But now the archaeologist Eilat Mazar, she's an Israeli archaeologist who is in fact the third in the generation of Israeli archaeologists. She has excavated the city, this area, and has uncovered what she believes to be the palace of David. Here's an artist's impression of what she envisages the city of David to roughly look like in David's day. Just a fairly small city on that spur of land, and the stone stepped stone structure was supporting a much bigger building, which the foundations of which was called the large stone structure. So here is Eliot Mazar's excavations of the large stone structure. And it turned out, and most archaeologists now agree, although there are some who disagree, that this is in fact the remains of the palace that Hiram built for David. It has surrounded by a huge wall, and it seems that that stepped stone structure was there to prop it up. Maybe it started subsiding due to its nearness to the edge. But anyway, that is the wall of the citadel of David, the palace of David in Jerusalem. Here is the ground plan of what has been excavated so far. The stepped stone structure is on the left, and that was supporting a huge wall, about 8 metres thick, a huge one. And you can see then the courtyards and the foundations of the walls and the other rooms they enclose. This represents only about a quarter of the site area, and I think it's probably difficult to excavate the rest, but maybe they will be able to do so in time. Now here are some of the actual rooms of David's palace. It's interesting to think, isn't it, that these walls once echoed to the voice of David, the man after God's own heart. It was while he was sitting, maybe, in an adjoining room when Nathan appeared to him to tell him of God's promise that his greater son would one day rule in Jerusalem forever. It's intriguing to think of the links that attach to such buildings as this. Well, one might say, well, how do we know that this, in fact, was dating from David's time? Well, the answer is that this palace was built on a layer of pottery used as rubble. These are some of the examples that are underneath the foundations of these walls that we saw in the previous picture. Now, I expect you know that dating historical periods by the pottery it contains is a very, very accurate science. And the archaeologists date these pots to about 1200 BC, or maybe 1100 BC, certainly before the time of David, who reigned about 1000 BC. But those were under the walls. In the buildings themselves, on the floor of those rooms, they found other pots, and these date specifically from 1000 BC, from David's actual time. So we can be pretty sure that this building dates from the time of David. Another interesting thing is that nearby was found this carved stone, which is a proto-Ionic capital. Now, I expect some of you who studied architecture might have known you have various types of copper capital, you know, the Doric, the Ionic, the Corinthian, and so on. And the Ionic was the one that has scrolls on the top. Well, this was a very early form of Ionic capital, a proto-Ionic capital. And obviously that marks near the lintel of a huge gateway. Now, similar ones are found at Hazor, and this is a reconstruction of the Ionic capitals found at Hazor. But in the view of the fact that a similar one was found at Jerusalem, it is quite possible that the entrance to David's palace looked something like this. We can't be sure, but it is certainly quite a possibility. And so we can reconstruct the palace. This is what the archaeologists have done with the data which is now available. You can imagine why the agricultural Judeans would need the expert Phoenicians to come and build an edifice like this. They had no experience of stonework or major building work. And apparently this is typical Phoenician architecture. So we probably could imagine David living in a place like this. Certainly it lends colour, doesn't it, to the reference in Samuel when he walked upon the roof of his house and saw Bathsheba. So it again helps us to visualise the situation a little bit more. Just a little brief interruption from our historical sequence and to talk about writing in those days. Now, at a place called Kirbet Kayafa, again in the Shephelah, the lowlands, this clay tablet was found. It wasn't a tablet, isn't it? It's a potsherd with writing on it. You might just be able to make out writing on it. It's very, very faint, but here's a drawing of it. Now, this is the earliest Hebrew writing ever found. It predates the script in the time of Hezekiah and the Siloam inscription, and certainly the more stylized Hebrew writing of much later times. But it's interesting to think that this is probably the figures and the alphabet that David would have used to write the Psalms that we're reading at the moment. He would have been very adept at writing like this. Though it's absolutely Greek to us, it has been translated by one or two archaeologists, and again, this is a provisional translation. And the chief point is that it seems to refer to the fact that they've established a king. The men of the chief and the chief officers have established a king. And there's references to do not oppress and serve God. The judges and the widow wept. He had power over the resident alien and eliminated them. It seems to suggest that there's been a change. The judges no longer oppressed. The widows had been weeping, were no longer. The resident aliens, maybe the Philistines, have now been dispersed. And in confirmation, if it is referring to the anointing of Saul, which is a possibility but not a certainty, it certainly confirms what Samuel told him about the number of servants he would enlist into his service. The interesting thing is that, as I've indicated there, the site that was originally, or is known today, as Kirbet Kefaya, by the local Arabs, is known as Kirbet Daudi, which is their version of David. So it seems that, according to Arab tradition, David had some link with this place. So maybe it's a reference to him being made king as well. But we don't know. One or two other things. In Jerusalem, near Gihon, was found this engraved bowl, the main picture there. It was inscribed before the clay was fired, and it was inscribed with the owner's name, and the name is Benaiah, and it dates from the time of Hezekiah. And in the time of Hezekiah, we read of Eliel, Isamachar, Mahath, and Benaiah were overseers under the hand of Kenaniah at the commandment of Hezekiah the king and Azariah the ruler of the house. So this may have been a pot that Benaiah had dedicated to the temple, maybe in some form of offering. Now, the bottom right-hand one, they say there's a first mention of the name Bethlehem. This dates back to the time of David again. This is one, again, that was found by that sifting process that they were carrying out in Jerusalem. And this is interesting because it was a clay impression that was attached to items which had been taxed. So this is a tax receipt. the accountants among us might be interested in that. Here's a tax receipt dating from the time of David. The other one also is interesting. This comes from again from Jerusalem and found by that sifting process. And here is a seal, a clay seal, which was attached to an object which had gone through the ritual cleansing process determined by the law. And this is to indicate that it had passed the test. And so if they had an animal with that seal on, they know that it was kosher. Interesting little confirmation, isn't it, of the Bible. confirmation of the Bible record. Now, going back to David's palace, this continued for something like 400 years until it was destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar. So all the successive kings use this as their base, as their palace, and there are many references in the Kings and Chronicles to the palace of the king. And going back to the layout of the bit that's been uncovered so far, they found there something that drew headlines in Jerusalem about 2 or 3 years ago. Archaeologists unearthed proof of the plot to kill the prophet Jeremiah. Now, we know that Jeremiah tells us a lot about the people who lived in Jeremiah's day. He had his allies and he had his opponents. One of the allies was Gemariah, son of Shaphan. And in Jeremiah 36, we read that he, that's Barak, went down to the king's house, into the scribe's chamber. That's when he was reading the scroll that Jeremiah had written, we may remember. Went down into the king's house, into the scribe's chamber, and lo, all the princes sat there. And among them, Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, and all the princes. So, and it was those princes that when Jeremiah had to flee because Jehoiakim had burnt the scroll, that they protected him. Then later on, we read of others, and there's some evidence that they might have even been in a room like this. This maybe is that scribe's chamber that was found, that we read about in Jeremiah. Because the base of this room, I think it's this one, certainly a room similar to it, was littered with seals. A seal in those days was used to authenticate something. It was either on a ring or on a string round someone's neck. The official, it was like his signature. He had his own particular reference, identification. If they wanted to seal a document, they would make a little bobble of wet clay and impress this in it. And then when it dried, that would have been sealed and the string that tied it up. And in the floor of that chamber, they found no less, this is the recent archaeologist, found no less than hundreds of clay seals. Now, I know this is a rather poor photograph, it's the best I could get. But these are not the seals themselves, but the impressions of the seals. And I've arrowed ones where you might just be able to indicate some writing. So it seems that in this scribe's chamber, the documents were stored. And when the king of Babylon burnt the city, then the documents would have been burnt and destroyed, but the seals remained. And the interesting thing is that amongst those seals were found others who opposed Jeremiah. Shephatiah, the son of Gedaliah, and son of Mattan, and Gedaliah the son of Pasha, Jukal the son of Shelemiah, Pasha the son of Malchiah, said to the king, "We beseech thee, let this man be put to death." Jeremiah was advocating surrender to Babylon, as we may remember. So these were the ones who wanted to kill him. This was a plot to kill Jeremiah. And in these locations, in the palace of David, were found the seal of Jeremiah, that was his friend, that was found outside the wall. The seal of Gedaliah was found just one side of the wall, and the seal of Jukal was found in a chamber there. It's interesting, isn't it, comforting that the very people mentioned by Jeremiah, the evidence of their existence has been proved 100%. Another interesting confirmation of the truth of Jeremiah is found in this tablet here. Now, this hasn't been discovered recently. In fact, it was found in Babylonia in the mid-1900s, maybe even the 1800s, because they found literally hundreds of clay tablets like this. Didn't know what they all meant, so they put them into bags and sent them off to the British Museum, where they remained in the British Museum vaults. And it was a job of archaeology students who were beginning to learn cuneiform writing to go through these and see if there's anything of interesting. That was how, for example, the Babylonian Chronicle was found about 40, 50 years ago. Well, only in 2007, this one was picked up by a student. And when he interpreted it, he found it read like this. It was a tablet of Nabushaushukin saying that he is the chief eunuch of Nebuchadnezzar. And it recorded his donation of gold to the temple of Babylon dating from the 10th year of the king's reign. So here we've got someone who was contemporary with Nebuchadnezzar, contemporary with the kings in Jerusalem, contemporary with Nebuchadnezzar. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar besieged Jerusalem and captured it, we're told that all the officials of the king of Babylon came and sat in the middle gate, Nergal-Sharezer of Samgar, then Nabar-Sarsekim, the Rabsaris. And that word Rabsaris isn't a proper name. It's Hebrew meaning the chief eunuch. So here is this man whose tablet is here, authenticated, his existence authenticated by the presence of his actual cuneiform tablet found in Babylon and translated only a few years ago. Well, let's rush forward now to Jerusalem in New Testament times. We come to the time of Herod, to the time of building the temple. We've already mentioned his great platform on which the temple was erected and how it required huge stones to produce it. Here, for example, are the famous stones of the Wailing Wall at Jerusalem. And if you go down that little passage under that archway to the left, the Israelis have built a tunnel right along the rest of Herod's platform wall. And you can see the size of the stones there. Compare those with those people in the distance. They're sort of 30 foot long, 6 foot high, 8 foot thick. Huge stones weighing tons and tons. Where did they come from? How did they get them there? Well, no one really knew until about 2 years ago. They were building a road north of Jerusalem and they came across the quarry that was the source of these stones. Just slightly higher level than Jerusalem, so on rollers they were probably able to bring them down. And here are the remains of where the excavations took place for the Herod's platform and all the stones associated with it. Interesting confirmation, isn't it? Also, we found their tools there. They used to extract those stones in square shape by building a groove across the top of where they wanted to cut and banging in wedges. And here are the iron wedges that they used to bang in to split the stone. The thing in the centre, the odd thing, is in fact is a key. And one wonders whether it in fact dated to, well, did date to the time of the building of the temple. Was it actually a key to one of the doors of the temple? Who knows? Talking of Herod, he was an amazing builder. Not only did he build the temple platform, he built palaces throughout the land. And particularly did he build his own mausoleum. That is a place now called Herodium, just a few miles south of Bethlehem. Here it is. No, it's not an extinct volcano. It is, in fact, a man-made heap. I mean, they talk about the pyramids being self-aggrandizement of the pharaohs. What about this one, built by Herod to house his tomb? If there was ever a megalomaniac, it was him. And this is in keeping with the New Testament record, isn't it? Because we know that Herod was a very egotistical person. Now, this has been excavated in, again, it's ongoing excavation, certainly within the last 10 years. At the base of the Herodian mound was found this ornamental lake with an island in the middle. Obviously, the water's now gone. A series of colonnades, and there's some others, you can just see their shadows of them on the bottom right, so they went round the pool. Further along was a palace, and then there was a winding path going up to the top. You can just see a bit of it right at the top there. And this has been excavated since 2007. Here are the excavations to date. You can see the ornamental pool with the pillars around. You can see the path going up, winding round the mound. And right at the top are the remains of some ruins. Now, an artist's impression tells us that this is what it looked like just before Herod died. It's an amazing structure, isn't it? Think of all the wealth that he must have extracted from the Jews to be able to produce a series of structures such as this. Well, that's the artist's impression. Obviously, those towers have long since gone, but they have been excavated. And here is an aerial view looking down on the ruins as they are at the moment. A whole series of towers. You see the path going up on the left-hand side. Courtyards, rooms. And here is a reconstruction of what it looked like in Herod's day. An absolutely amazing building. Rooms in those towers, central rooms, personal private rooms, a terraced garden on the first floor leading up to the towers. Now, the archaeologist expected to find Herod's tomb somewhere in this huge complex. Now, why would he have built it if he wasn't going to be buried there? But so far, nothing has been found. But what has been found is a structure on the path leading up to it. And these are the remains of it. It was a huge structure. It's 30 foot square, and it's estimated that it was about 70 foot high. And on the top of it was an urn, which they actually discovered on site. So this gives us an idea of what it must have looked like. Probably a huge domed structure with three chambers, an upper one, a middle one, and a lower one. And in one of those, they found a sarcophagus. Here is the archaeologist's reconstruction of what it might have looked like. Don't be deceived by the size of that. That is a quarter-scale model made actually of plastic, which they have put on the site, which they thought was actually Herod's burying place, because in there they did find a sarcophagus, but it had been broken and smashed to pieces, and you can see it's been reconstructed quite a bit. But the archaeologist thought, well, this doesn't look like the great Herod's sarcophagus. He was, as we say, a very important, flamboyant person, and this seemed to be a comparatively ordinary one. So they're still not really sure that Herod was buried there, and that was his tomb. There were no bones inside. The tomb was completely smashed, and that was probably done by the ones who made the rebellion against the Romans in the time of Bar Kokhba, who lived in this area, and they hated Herod, and they tried to deface all his monuments, and it is possible that they destroyed this mausoleum and desecrated the bones inside. But, as we say, a replica has been made, and there it sits on the path up to the Herodium. The archaeologists are still probing the main Herodian building in the hope they might yet find Herod's tomb, but they can't be sure. We have to watch the space. Well, our final example is one that also comes from Jerusalem and from New Testament times. This is how it's described. Israeli archaeologists have discovered a 2,000-year-old gold earring beneath a parking lot next to the walls of Jerusalem's old city. The discovery dates back to the time of Christ during the Roman period, says Don Benami, the director of excavations at the site. What a wonderful piece of jewellery. Huge pearls, beautiful twined gold work. Must have belonged to some very important lady. But here is a pearl of great price indeed, although it has probably been attempted to be embellished by the exquisite workmanship of those days. But we, don't we, have something of even more value. We have a pearl of great price. Something that's much more valuable than that precious stone. And we've found that pearl enshrined not in a gold wire frame, but enshrined in the Word of God. So may it be that the things that we've considered this evening will strengthen our assurance that, as the psalmist said, the word of the Lord is right.